Hi, welcome to this week's program. Here's something we all know from hearsay. College expenses have been steadily rising over the years. For example, just annual tuition and fees, not counting room and board, for a four-year college degree at a public university cost $2,400 on average in 1975. That same four-year public university degree costs $9,400 per year in the 2015-16 school year, which is still a bargain compared to the $32,400 in annual tuition and fees you would have paid at a private four-year college in 2015. But public or private, you're looking at about a 3.5% annual increase in tuition and fees. And while that might not seem like a lot, it adds up quickly year after year, especially if you have a newborn and you're looking at where fees might be 16 to 18 years from now. So how do you plan ahead so you have enough to cover your child's tuition and fees several years down the road? Well, thankfully, that's not hard to figure out. With some thoughtful planning, you can come up with a reasonable estimate of your magic number for saving for college. So here's what you need to consider as you start planning ahead. All right, first, the type of school you'd like your child to attend. The cost of attendance varies greatly depending on whether you want a 2- or 4-year school and whether it's public or private. Costs range from around $11,000 to about $44,000, including room and board, per year in 2015, according to a recent survey by the College Board. Also, you may have a sense of the kinds of students your children really are, even at a fairly young age. If you're honest, you can make an educated guess whether the child is Harvard-bound or state college-bound so you can plan accordingly. Now, room and board, which accounts for a large portion of the cost of attendance, is one area where you can save money by having your child live at home in the first year or two, if that's feasible. Though, let me warn you, that's not likely to go down well with your young, college-bound freshman who'd rather be on campus enjoying the college experience. Number three, according to the College Board's recent study, prices increased by about 3% from the 2014-15 school year to the 15-16 school year. It's best to err on the side of caution and choose a relatively high inflation rate, let's say 5%, as you calculate how much money you'll need to save. Thankfully, many students don't pay full price because of institutional and federal grants and tax benefits. So, depending on your financial circumstances and your child's educational prowess, your child's four-year degree could cost between 10 to 25% less. But I'd rather you not fall short, so save the full amount if you can and consider money saved to be a bonus after the fact. And here's number five. Many parents believe that your children should help pay for school through work or student loans. If you decide to have your child contribute, make sure he or she is aware of the risk and burden involved in taking on debt. Now, let's put this all together with an example. Say you're a newly married couple and want to plan for college for your new baby, and you already have a type of in-state school in mind. Figure out the estimated in-state cost of attendance for the 2016-17 year at that university. Let's say it's about $26,500 in total per year. Now, figure out how much you'd like your child to contribute. Say you decide your child's share should be around $12,000 of that $26,500. So, your contribution works out to $26,500 less $12,000, which is $14,500 for the first year. Increase that by 5% each year, and you're looking at $15,200 for the second year, $16,000 for the third year, and about $16,800 for the fourth year. Add it all up, and you're looking at about $62,500 in today's dollars. Now, factor in college expenses' historic inflation rate of 5% over the next 18 years, so that may be $150,000 in tomorrow's dollars 18 years from now. Now, if all goes well, you may get somewhere between a 10 and a 25% discount on that number, so you could be looking at something in the range of $112,500 to $135,000 that you should have in your child's college account 18 years from today. Not cheap. If you experience a 6.5% average rate of return annually on your money that you set aside for their college and reinvest in your earnings, you'll need to set aside about $300 per month to get to that $120,000 in 18 years. But that's assuming you start saving soon after or even before the baby is born. If, like most Americans, you don't get a head start on saving for your child's college as soon as they're born, you'll have to set aside significantly more each month to catch up. For instance, if you have just 10 years to save for college, instead of $300 per month, you'll need to save $700 per month, assuming the same costs and returns. So clearly, the sooner you start, the better. The magic of compounding, as I always say. Now, of course, if your child is smart and wants to go to a top engineering school in the country, say MIT or an Ivy League, your college bill will most likely cost more and living at home won't be an option. So plan ahead. Set up a reasonable plan for savings, make periodic adjustments to your contributions, and make the most of what you have so you can give your child all the opportunities for success our great nation offers. And finally, think of saving for college as a four-legged stool. 1, you save and pay. 2, you pay out some of current income while they're in school. 3, they take summer jobs and work a little while they're in school. And 4, they take some student loans. Also consider the age you will be when they're 18 and the fact that you will want to be saving for yourself too. You will have fewer years to reach your retirement goals, but they will have their whole life in front of them. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. Paige DeFiore is the formal editorial assistant at Credit.com. She's a blogger and generally really just a smart cookie. The proof of this is a recent piece she penned drawing on the actions of the nefarious, troubled, and downright dangerous Harry Potter villain Lord Voldemort. It's his diabolical actions that, when used for good, can serve as an example of how to get what you really want out of your money. Welcome to the show, Paige.
Yes, nice to be here.
So let's get this out of the way. You know, Lord Voldemort is a very, very nasty character, and you're not suggesting anybody murder anyone or become a villainous snake wizard, right?
Definitely not.
Okay, that's good to hear. By the way, for those of you who don't know, Voldemort's main goal was to kill Harry Potter, but how does this make him a good example for someone who's good at managing money? Let's find out. So tell us what transpired to make you think about Lord Voldemort and being a good steward of your own money.
Well, when it comes to finance, I know that when it's tied to something that I have an interest in, it's so much easier for me to understand and want to read about it. So when I was trying to come up with ideas, I was trying to think of what's something that's really strange and crazy to kind of pair with money. And I thought, how about one of the worst villains of all time?
What about his actions and the way he feels about things that would make him a successful money manager?
I mean, he is dedicated. There are so many movies, and every movie has the same goal. So when you're saving money, if you're dedicated, that's the first step. Mm-hmm. And he's also very widely broadcasting his mission. Everyone knows that he wants to kill Harry Potter. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to saving money, if everyone knows that you're saving money, it makes it so much easier.
Well, he lives... Actually, he's dead now, I guess. You know, talking about a fictional character being dead. But he was driven by so much hate for Harry Potter and what he represented that every single day he plotted to destroy him. So are you suggesting that a person get to a certain point, maybe not through hate, but through some other feeling to get their act together?
I mean, I think it's a great motivator. If you're really motivated, if you kind of paint like debt as a villain, it can be really helpful in kind of making you want to like just take control and conquer it.
Well, you know, also in the case of Voldemort, it led to a lot of career longevity because he was in 8 movies and 7 books. So
yeah.
Maybe there's a lesson there as well. What are some of the other characteristics? You write, be ruthless with yourself. What's that mean?
When it comes to money, it can be hard because you don't want to feel like you're depriving yourself by saving, but you really need to be a bit ruthless. You really need to look at where you're spending your money and think, do I really need this? Is this something that is making my life so much better that I can't afford to be without it? He's just very ruthless. He just didn't care and kind of stuck to his main goal. And when you stick to your main goal, you have to be a little ruthless with yourself and be a little hard on yourself, at least I think.
In your article, you had a link to how to save without feeling deprived, and I copied and pasted that. So let's talk a little bit about that. To prime your frugality pump, as it's written here, some painless ways to pinch pennies without depriving yourself of the things that you enjoy. Number one, I guess, brew your own coffee instead of going out and spending. You're not depriving yourself of coffee, and maybe the coffee's actually a little bit better. Any other ideas of ways to save without feeling deprived?
I think when you're looking to buy things for yourself, if you really kind of go through what you have and see how many things that you already own, and to just focus on being grateful rather than saying, I need the next thing, I need this thing, because in reality, you're probably not as deprived as you think. If you kind of take a moment to kind of have gratitude for what you have, you might not feel as inclined to spend.
Yeah, you know, and maybe quit eating out as often as you do. Shop smart. Don't fall for the stores' tricks. You know, they are masters at marketing and they know how to target your emotions. And make sure that you understand your emotions and you can walk away. Because, you know, really the facts are that if you don't act and you do walk away, there's actually, I believe, just a 90% chance that you won't end up buying that item on the spur of the moment. Here's another one that interests me about your article about Lord Voldemort is wear a uniform. Why would that help me?
One of the biggest ways a lot of people spend money, I know a lot of my money is spent on clothes, is when you feel like you need to keep following trends and buying new outfits. But a really big thing, and it's really famous with a lot of CEOs, is kind of wearing a uniform, wearing the same outfit almost every day or every day. You just have a go-to outfit formula and it kind of downsizes your wardrobe and you could sell other clothes and you won't feel as inclined to spend money on clothes, and it will also save you a lot of stress when you're worrying about what to wear.
Especially, I think, for women. I think men tend to kind of wear the same thing pretty much every day. I know I keep a blazer in my office and I kind of come to work with, you know, basically a shirt, no tie here in South Florida. And then when it comes time to see clients, I put the blazer on and it's really quite simple and really, I guess, don't spend. But I'll tell you one thing I do is when I do buy clothes, I buy good quality clothes. And while you may pay up for that initially, in the long run, it's best because the clothes last longer.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Here's another one, and you mentioned this before, share your mission. I mean, everybody knew that Lord Voldemort wanted to find and kill Harry Potter. Why is sharing your mission so important?
I think when people around you know your goals and know that you're really trying to stick to them, you have people that will hold you accountable. And when it comes like time for the holidays or when your friends constantly want to go out to eat and they know you're on a budget, they might better accommodate you. You might say, hey, like this year, the gifts aren't going to be as expensive and it's not going to be like really difficult because they know your mission and they really want to help you once they know what you're trying to do.
I think there's also a psychological aspect of talking about it, of getting it out there and getting other people involved as opposed to kind of just, you know, internalizing it and kind of suffering yourself. There's some kind of catharsis that they may help you succeed at this well. Here's another fact. A focus on actually understanding. I guess Voldemort's ultimate demise resulted from his lack of understanding about a certain curse. Tell me about that.
So had he known that a certain curse would backfire when he used it at the time that he used it, he probably could have avoided getting killed at least for a bit longer. So when it comes to money, if you actually understand your finances and know your credit score and know what all of it means, you're setting yourself up for success. Because if you go into something not actually knowing what's going on, just kind of like, oh, I'm going to save money, but you don't actually know the intricacies of it, it can backfire.
Yeah, so don't be caught up in denial. And remember the old idea that if you're sitting at a poker table and you're wondering who the patsy is, that means you're the patsy. So you got to be the smartest person in the room. And one way to do that is to know your stuff. Know your credit score, know what's in your bank account, know what your student loans are, know what the rate on the student loans are. Just know your stuff so you don't make a big mistake. Here's one, keep a diary. Why is that important?
I think that when you can see where you're spending your money, where you're getting your money from, if it's all laid out in front of you, whether it's on physical paper or even on an app, there are so many apps out there, it can really help you like look at everything and cut your spending because you can see where everything's going. It's not just like a vague idea. And it's also a lot easier to keep track of your savings when you have it all written down.
Okay. My guest, Paige DeFiore, former editorial assistant at credit.com, blogger. What is the name of your blog, Paige?
It's called Eyeliner Wings and Pretty Things.
EyelinerWingsAndPrettyThings.com. Pretty cool. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
To hear this segment again and to find out all the links that we mentioned here with Paige, don't forget to come to our website and follow our show at stevepomerantz.com. All bull markets come to an end eventually. We all know that someday this party's going to stop. The question you need to ask yourself is, will I be ready when it does? Now, this is exactly the topic I'll be speaking on at my next event, which will be Tuesday, December 12th at 10 a.m. at the Aqualina Resort in Aventura. Now, while the timing of the next downturn can't be predicted, I will give you some insights as to what to look for to protect your wealth. Also, I'll talk about the questions that I'm constantly getting from listeners and clients. Questions like, what does the current administration's success or failure mean to the health of my wealth? And really, do politics even matter? What will be the effect, if any, of the new tax law if it's passed? And we know that high market volatility is going to come roaring back. So what can you do now to prepare and protect yourself? And can you even put yourself in a financial position where a downturn won't matter to you? I'll show you what it takes to do that. And of course, I'm going to help you break free from the terrible buy high, sell low, repeat until broke syndrome. All this and more. You know, always, my mission is to educate and empower you, which I've been doing for over 15 years on NPR affiliates and in my own investment practice for 35 years. So protect your wealth this holiday season and join me at the Aqualina Resort in Aventura, Tuesday, December 12th at 10 a.m. That's 10 a.m. Tuesday, December 12th at the Aqualina Resort in Aventura. Seating is limited, of course, so sign up at our website, stevepomerantz.com. That's stevepomerantz.com. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. I'm not sure if I'm statistically correct here, but my personal experience and the experience of a lot of my friends this summer has been one of numerous flight delays and requests to give up their seats. Add to this the United Airlines disaster, which went viral when Dr. David Dow was forcibly dragged off the plane, ending up in the hospital. And I began to wonder, what is really going on here? What are our rights and what are we entitled to if the airline decides they need our seat? So to get the definitive answer, I've invited Caitlin Pitzker to join me. She follows this for Kiplinger Personal Finance. Hey, Caitlin, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
First, I want to get some perspective. What is life from the point of view of the airline? How do they look at their passengers and this overbooking business?
Well, you know, you've really posed an interesting question and one I think that's on a lot of people's minds at this point. But from the perspective of the airline, they, of course, are interested in having a full flight. When that flight departs, they want someone in every seat, a paying customer, to keep their bottom line, you know, in the positive. So it's pretty common for airlines to sell more tickets for a flight than the number of seats that are actually available on that plane, which is why customers are running into what you just described.
Well, why do they sell more seats? I mean, if they have a full flight, why are they overbooking?
Airlines generally bank on at least a few passengers either changing flight or perhaps missing their flight, but for whatever reason, not making that flight. And they, of course, run the numbers and make those decisions. But there are scenarios in which more people show up at that gate than there are seats. And that's when you run into these questions about overbooked flights and what your rights are when there are too many people for that flight.
Yeah, so you have the intersection of their data crunching and technology saying to them, well, we know X percentage is going to be empty on average, so therefore we're going to overbook by X percent, which is fine if we were digits or something. We were not humans with emotions, but now you're interceding in a person's life. You're making them delay. You're making them change their plane, and it can create some tension. So, you know, for us passengers, we feel like we have something tangible. We have a pre-purchased fully paid ticket. We have a seat assigned to us. We own this. And it's like we feel like we're in a sacred position. Are we or are we not?
Well, what you described is pretty common. A lot of people say, I've booked this ticket. I have a confirmed reservation. I have a seat assignment. But regardless of those things, you are still agreeing to what's called a contract of carriage. It's a contract that you have with the airline that allows them to do certain things. Mm. It protects them if the flight is delayed or if they need to perhaps give you a different seat. Perhaps you've been booked in the aisle seat that you really like. Something changes and they need to change your seat assignment. It provides a number of different protections. It's a contract you can't get out of. It's just kind of there and most people don't read it.
Yeah, well, there's one thing to understand that, you know, if they move your seat, now I guess you feel like you own that seat because you've ordered it. But it's another thing entirely for them to say you can't get on this plane. So let's get into that. You know, first of all, I don't know any other product where they can just kind of arbitrarily take away something that you've already purchased with cash. But, you know, I guess this is just different. So let's take a little time to discuss the rights of us weary passengers. Let's start with flights that are delayed. Now, I guess these are outside of the control, in many times, of the airlines. What happens when a flight is delayed?
Well, there's two types of flight delays, or two major types, I should say. Some fall into mechanical or staffing issues that are within the realm of control of the airline or at least their responsibility. And then, of course, you have weather or natural related delays. And those are kind of the two big categories. And how passengers are treated and compensated in those situations can certainly vary based on if a crew member doesn't show up or a crew member is over their allowed time for the day versus if there's a huge storm that comes in and flights are grounded.
Oh, so there can be some compensation or arrangements made if the delay is because of staffing rather than weather. I thought perhaps there was nothing you could do if a flight was delayed.
You know, there are some protections. They're not perhaps as robust as most consumers would think that they are, but really your standing is improved if it's an airline issue. Perhaps they scheduled poorly. But in either case, we would be talking about significant delays, not a short period of time.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. All right, so let's get to the hard part here, which is the overbooked flight. And now a situation arises where a seat needs to be freed up for whatever reason. What is the first order of business with regards to the airlines?
So the situation that you've described is fairly common, and usually it's resolved in this first way that we'll talk about. The airline will ask for volunteers. This happens, I see it all the time when I travel. It happens pretty frequently. The airline will make an announcement either at the gate or sometimes even on the website when you're checking in or on the smartphone app if you're using that, saying, we've overbooked this flight and we're looking for volunteers. They'll start with an opening bid, usually a couple $100s depending on, you know, if it's a short duration flight, it's a common flight, they're going to kind of maybe offer a little bit less. But they'll present an opening number and see if they can get a few people to volunteer. Mm-hmm. And personally, I like to look for these offers. It's a great way to get a travel voucher. If you travel fairly often and can be a little flexible with your travel plans, you might be able to take a future trip for almost nothing out of pocket.
Sure. But you have to be flexible. I guess that is the key. And it has to be okay for you to be delayed many hours or maybe even overnight.
Well, it depends on the situation. I know for me, a lot of times I see them on flights that the next flight is in an hour or an hour and a half. And I say, well, if you want to offer me $150 to hang out for an hour, that's good return on my money.
Okay.
But you should always ask when that next flight is that they would get you on. Because the deal is they'll give you that travel voucher and get you on the next flight. But if the next flight's not till morning, you certainly would want to make sure that A, your schedule accommodates that. And B, that they're going to offer you, say, overnight accommodations if you're not in your hometown. Or some meal vouchers, something to help sweeten the deal a little bit.
I think you also want them to offer you a specific seat, not a standby on the next flight.
That's right. Talk with the gate agent about exactly what you're getting, not just the dollar value of that voucher, but which flight you would be on, which seat you would have on that flight. That can be a little tricky depending on how far out that flight is, but you might even be able to negotiate if they're really eager to get a volunteer. You might be able to negotiate a better seat on that flight, maybe with a little extra legroom or some little bonus for your troubles.
Yeah, so I think the key takeaway here is that you use the word they'll offer you a few $100 or travel voucher. It's an offer. It's not necessarily engraved in stone. If they're asking for volunteers and nobody volunteers, and I just was on a flight like that, they must have asked 10 times. So therefore, at least 9 out of the 10 times, nobody came forth. So they may be getting a little bit more desperate. So there is a degree of negotiability here. Is that right?
That's right. So in a situation like you described, where they've offered numerous times, they're still not getting the volunteers that they need, airlines will typically start increasing the dollar value of that voucher. Mm-hmm. I personally have seen a couple where even when I didn't want to be flexible, I've strongly considered it, because it can be really lucrative if you're willing to give a little. But if you decide to step up, if they've hit a dollar value where you're interested, there might be more room for negotiation if they're really having trouble getting those volunteers. So, you know, be polite, but feel free to ask for, say, meal vouchers if you're the only volunteer and they're really struggling, or maybe lounge access for the day if you're going to be hanging out in the airport for several hours.
There you go. So there's other things you can ask for besides money. I like that. If you're hanging out for hours, you can go to their special lounge. You can maybe get extra room in your seating, some other perk they can give to you as opposed to just pure cash. Now, you mentioned them giving you vouchers. Can you ask for cash and get a check?
In this situation, we're talking strictly about vouchers. So I would personally recommend doing this on an airline that you travel at least reasonably often, because they do have expiration dates.
Okay.
You know, if you never want to fly that airline again, I probably would not suggest taking the voucher. But they still can be a nice way to travel again in the future for relatively little out of pocket.
Now, United recently announced that it will offer up to $10,000 in vouchers to customers who volunteer to give up a seat. Delta increased the maximum amount to volunteers to $9,950. Can I get that?
You know, I wouldn't hold your breath necessarily, but what they're trying to do there, particularly after the April incident that you referenced earlier, is give gate agents and the representatives who are there that you're seeing as a passenger, give them a little bit more power to sweeten the deal so we don't face a situation, or we face them less often, in which people are denied boarding involuntarily.
I'm speaking with Caitlin Pixer from Kiplinger Personal Finance. Okay, we've talked about volunteer. Everything is kind of hunky-dory. Everybody's still working together here. But when the airline just says, your seat is denied, you cannot get on this plane, is that time to put the gloves on? What must the airline give you in compensation? Because I know it's written in the rules. What are those rules?
So you've again posed a great question. I should first underscore that this is not a common scenario. Most things are resolved with that voluntary bumping system, in which people are negotiating a little bit of a deal and hopefully everybody walks away happy. But if we get to this point, at least you're looking at some cash compensation for your troubles.
So the bottom line is, know your rights. Go to Kiplinger.com and actually just type in know your rights on flights, right? That's easy to remember. Know your rights on flights. And also there's a link to the Department of Transportation letter about what the rules are. And I will say it's written in very plain English, easy to understand, and maybe something you want to take a picture of, put it on your phone. And so if you're in the airport and you find yourself in this situation, you've got the facts right in front of you. Thank you so much, Caitlin, for joining us and for filling us in on this very important issue. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
To find out more about Caitlin, to hear this interview again, don't forget to join the conversation at stevepomerantz.com.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes, little boxes, little boxes all the same. There's a green one and a pink one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for a real estate roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 29-year veteran with Coldwell Banker, located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
So we are kind of in the mode of Congress trying to figure out a new tax bill, and it has some implications for real estate. Name one for me.
Well, first, you know, the current capital gains is up to $500, which is a home sales tax exemption. As long as the seller owns a home and resides in the property for 2 of the 5 years. But Congress wants to change that to 5 out of 8 years. So what does that mean? It means you're going to have to stay in your house longer if you're in a capital gains situation. Again, that means you have to have gains of over $500,000. Typically, Steve, you're not going to see that in your average home unless the market really accelerated and appreciated. That's not a house value of $500,000. That means you actually profited.
Yeah. So you bought it for $100,000 and it's now worth $600,000. That $500,000 difference is exempt from tax.
Right. And then you have to factor in, let's say you put in new kitchens and baths, that's all.
Oh, sure. That increases your cost.
Yes, exactly.
So if you put in $50,000 and you paid $100,000, you put in $50,000 to fix your kitchen. Now your cost basis is $150,000. So now the tax.
So save your receipts.
Save your receipts, mm-hmm. Right. So this is really only for those who have appreciation greater than $500,000.
Right.
Okay.
That's one of the changes. So, you know, I don't know if it's really going to hurt that many people. You know, they're saying that half the sellers are, you know, between 18 and 34. They're the ones who tend to move quicker because it's their first home. Their incomes are growing. They're more apt to make a move up. And if you take away a tax incentive, they're thinking that maybe they'll stay longer in their houses. And then it slows down, you know, new people trying to enter into the marketplace from being able to buy.
Yeah, but still, I mean, the first $500,000 is tax exempt. How many people are really going to experience growth in 2 years of their home greater than $500,000?
Right.
It's a very small amount. You know, talking about taxes, let's talk about this idea about eliminating the interest deduction that you get from your mortgage.
Right.
What is your industry saying about that? I'm sure they're not happy about that.
Oh, yeah. Well, the industry is jumping up and down saying, no, you can't touch that. It's going to hurt our industry. Obviously, I'm going to fight on the side of the realtors and say, yes, that's not a good thing. But at the same time, I'm not well versed enough in knowing all the ins and outs of this. Because, for example, they're saying they're going to take away the mortgage deductions, but then they're going to increase standard deductions like the marriage. I don't know what it's at now, but raise that to like $24,000.
Yeah.
So I don't know how many people are going to be affected or not be affected. This is the way that I look at it. It's an incentive. It's a benefit. But at the end of the day, people need roofs over their houses, whether they rent a house or they purchase a house or drive their house around, you know.
Yeah, you need a roof over your head.
You need a roof over your head.
The taxes are like a nice bonus. Think of it this way, too. So let's say you have credit card debt. You know, sometimes at the end of the year when you're doing your taxes, you say, oh, I wish this credit card interest was tax deductible. But it's not. The only thing that's tax deductible is your mortgage interest. But yet, these people, you're still going to have credit card debt because you're using it. You've got other things in mind for the use of that card. And it's the same thing with a house. You're still going to have to buy a house. And yeah, it would be nice to get the mortgage deduction. But I really agree with you. I don't really think that's the primary driver when it comes to buying a house.
Right.
Yeah. We shall see. Neither of us are experts in this area.
No,
but I think.
Yeah. So I'm going to fight that the deduction stays. But whether or not it does, I don't know.
All right. So, you know, a few weeks ago, there was an article in the New York Times which discussed the fact that rental markets seemed to be softening a little bit because millennials were going out and buying single family homes. And yet you've presented me with some information that says that single family rentals, which includes townhouses, are actually edging out the purchase of single family homes. Take us there.
Yeah, apparently the builders are building a lot of the rental townhomes, single family homes. And there's an attraction, especially by the millennials, for these type of properties. And basically, the bottom line is they can't afford quite yet to purchase a home.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, on the flip side, from a builder's point of view, I've got to believe the reason why they're doing it is it's more profitable somehow. You know, not being a builder, I don't know what the costs are building a rental complex or even a rental single family home versus a home that they sell. But apparently that seems to be the trend.
Well, the trend is probably created to some degree by the fact that there's a lot of millennials that don't have enough money for a down payment to buy a home. So they're renting.
Right. Obviously, there's a demand for it. So,
yeah.
You know, one person wrote or said, I can buy lots in areas that I can't sell homes, but I can rent.
Yeah. So they can buy the lot, but the builder is saying, I can't build a home to sell it, but I can build a home to rent it.
Right.
And I think that speaks total volumes. So I want to switch gears here a little bit. I want to ask a question about something we were talking about off air. And here's the question. Should a buyer allow the seller to stay in the house after closing?
You know, we hate to do it, and sometimes it's a necessary evil. And there's two theories in it. If you're going to do it, I say you have something in writing. In a particular case that I just experienced, the buyer said, you know what, I don't want anything in writing, because if he's not out in 48 hours like he says he's going to be, then I'm calling the police for trespassing.
Mm.
I am the rightful owner of the property, and I have nothing in writing giving him permission to remain there. Where I say if it's in writing, then you have some legal recourse. But in reality, then you have to evict him, and then you go through a whole process of eviction.
Yeah.
Just try as best you can to avoid the situation. Extend the closing if you have to. It can be a bad experience. I've seen all kinds of things occur.
You're trying to be a nice person.
You try to be a nice person. But it
could backfire on you.
Yeah, it's a very awkward situation when you're presented with it. And you want to be the nice person, do the right thing, but you have to protect yourself. So think it out thoroughly. Consult an attorney before you make that decision.
I agree.
Just know what the potential downfall is to it.
Yeah, think about what you might be getting yourself into.
Right. Liability.
Yeah. My guest, as always, is Terry Story. She's a 29-year veteran with Coldwell Banker, located in Boca Raton, Florida. And she can be found at terrystory.com. And she can be heard at stevepomerantz.com as well. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
This is Steve Pomerantz, and you're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. Okay, I'll admit it. I'm a Warren Buffett-ophile. Warren Buffett-ophile. I've studied him, I've invested like him, and I've attended his Berkshire Hathaway meetings for quite a while. So when I came across another book about him, you know, I'm interested, but I gave it a wary eye. What more can someone say about the man? This time, however, I discovered a book that looks at the early years of Buffett, something few books have attempted, and I discovered lessons that I think are particularly important in this day and time. It took the world's greatest investor nearly four decades to make his first $100 million. He made a lot of mistakes in the early years, and it wasn't all smooth or instant, and it took decades of ups and downs. So let's meet the author of this book and see what we can glean from his work. His book is The Deals of Warren Buffett. And with me is author Glenn Arnold. Welcome to the show, Glenn.
Hi, good to be here.
So you analyzed the individual investment deals in detail to reveal his approach. Why did you approach it from that angle, looking at the deals themselves?
Well, it didn't start off as a book at all, in fact. What I do is I left university about 4 years ago. I had a university chair here in the UK and left that in order to concentrate on investing. So what I spend my time doing is analyzing companies, obviously using Warren Buffett techniques, amongst others. I was a professor of investing, so I had a number of PhD students. So I have other techniques from that sort of background as well.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I analyze companies, and then I started putting my analysis on a website that my wife just created, a very cheap website. And that helped me in order to get my thoughts in order and also to remember why I invested in something. And then I track a long time, different rationales. As a year passes, I explain why I'm still invested or whether to buy or whatever. Anyway, eventually, a major investment website in the UK took that up and asked me if I would put it on their system, and then they could have subscribers for that. And while in between analysis of companies, because I didn't always have a company to analyze, I had to think of other things that I could present. So I presented academic material, and I thought, well, I need to learn about the details of Warren Buffett's analysis. How did he go about analyzing companies? And that wasn't in the books up until that point, because it's very much a case of they've got a lot to cover, you know, got 80 odd years to cover,
mm-hmm.
and they sort of go along the lines, this is a caricature, but it's along the lines of Buffett invested in this and then he made a fortune out of it. Yeah. And then he invested in something else and made a fortune. And I wanted to know the details of why. Why did he invest in something? Mm-hmm. And what was the real outcome? What was the details of those outcomes? Okay.
Well, that's what we want to know. Why? Why?
Yeah.
So tell us about his very early years. You know, as a teenager, I'm talking about before he went to college. Now, you wrote in the book that at 11 years old, he had already accumulated $120.
Yeah.
Now, this was in 1941 or so. Yeah. And I did some online math, and I found out that $120 in 1941 dollars is the equivalent of about $2,000 today. So unless you have a young child who's been through a confirmation or a bar mitzvah or something, mm-hmm. Very few of them are going to have $2,000 that they've earned on their own. So how did he make this much money at such a young age?
Well, you've got to remember the time. We're talking early 1930s, or rather right through the 1930s was his formative years. And of course, he saw a lot of poverty at that time, and he became determined to make money mm-hmm. and never to be dependent on others. So he found all sorts of ways of making a dollar. So he would take bottles of Coca-Cola to school or Wrigley's chewing gum to school and sell them individually, make a little bit of money that way. Then later on in his teenage years, he would do things like collect golf balls or have pinball machines in barbershops, made money all sorts of different ways. And obviously was saving as he went along. So I would guess that when he got Christmas money or birthday money, he would save that. So he was really determined.
Yeah. All right. So focus and this early desire to avoid poverty and to avoid what he saw around him.
Yeah.
You know, next, as we fast forward a little bit, I think his first real investment in the stock market. Now, his father was a stockbroker for a while, and then he became a congressman or senator, I'm not sure, and they moved to Washington. But the first investment that he made was a preferred stock that he bought, City Service. Mm. And there were some lessons there because we went in with his sister. And not long after he bought it, it went down. He felt pretty bad about that. Take us through that a little.
Yes, it started to go down. And he felt really guilty because he persuaded his sister to go in for this. And they held on. And it managed to go back above the price that they paid. They only bought 3 shares, by the way. And he sold out. And the profit was $5.25. Mm-hmm. That was it.
All right.
And the lessons he took from that were simply that, you know, because he followed the shares after that and they rocketed after he'd sold.
Yeah.
So he learned, well, don't grab at a small profit. You know, hold on in there if you're convinced of your analysis. Don't fixate on the price that you paid for a share.
There you go. That's a big lesson there.
That's a sunk cost.
Yes.
And when investing other people's money, ill feeling can be created and mistakes made.
Okay.
I remember John Templeton used to say, OPM is sacred. Other people's money is sacred.
Yeah. So it changes the way you look at things than if you would rather do them yourself. You're responsible for others. Let's fast forward 10 years later, age 20. He's now worth $20,000. And by the way, that's $188,000 today. And he bought Geico. Now, that's a name we all know because he still owns it. He still talks about it. And we see it advertised all the time. Mm. He spent $10,000 for Geico. Why Geico back then?
Ah, well, what started him off on that one was Benjamin Graham. By this stage, he was at university being taught by Benjamin Graham. And he noticed that Graham's company had shares in this company called Geico. In fact, they had a controlling interest in Geico. Mm. So he set off one Saturday morning to Washington and knocked on the door, hoping to speak to somebody. And luckily enough, there was a chap called Lorimer, the corporate finance chap at Geico was there. So this guy very generously gave this 21-year-old Buffett, who knocked on the door, a few minutes to talk about insurance and the company. They ended up talking for about 4 hours because Warren Buffett kept on throwing questions, very highly intelligent questions at him. He'd obviously done his homework. And Warren decided to invest in that company. And the reason was because of the strength of its franchise. The shares were lowly priced, but it had a terrific franchise. It had a very low cost distribution model, which was telephone sales, and it was to particularly low-risk people, government employees. Warren felt that there was a degree of customer captivity there. Mm-hmm. So the insurance could be sold nice and cheap, and it was a strong ongoing franchise.
I think there were big profit margins as well.
Yep.
Which he was attracted to. But I think one of the lessons here is you said the price was low. So this was not a popular stock.
No.
You know, we all get caught up in these companies that are in today's news.
Yeah.
Or that are, you know, sexy in some way. They make great products or whatever. You pay a lot for them in terms of the price that you're paying for every dollar's worth of earnings. It's a different kind of personality that goes in and just doesn't care what's popular, but looks kind of at the fundamentals saying, you know, there's value here for me to unlock.
Absolutely. The insurance analysts on Wall Street were quite down on the company, mm-hmm. mainly because it had a very small market share. And they thought market share was everything.
Yeah.
But of course, it's not. Mm-hmm. If you've got a very strong franchise because you've got strong relationships with your customers and you've got a unique distribution model, you can beat the big boys.
All you needed to do at some point is get someone in there who could lead the company and scale it up, which eventually happened. But it didn't happen before Buffett sold it, because he sold it for a 50% gain.
Yeah, just a year later.
Just a year later, right. And he bought it back many years later.
Oh, yes. There had to be a major crisis for him to buy back in.
Uh-huh.
I think it was 1974, early 70s anyway.
Okay.
And a new bunch of managers had taken over. And in insurance, you can do some very, very silly things, chasing after writing premiums.
Yeah.
You can underprice insurance risk mm-hmm. dramatically. And mm-hmm. it looks great for a while, right. but then something's going to hit you eventually. Mm-hmm. And it really did. And that company was pretty well bust.
Well, there's also a lesson in him having total understanding of the way that business worked and to see the difference between, you know, what bad management had wrought and what could be done to fix it.
Yeah, yeah. So he needed two things. So when he investigated the company, he went to speak to the bloke who'd just taken charge. So the first thing he needed was somebody who saw things his way, a really rational manager.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing he needed confirmation of was that it still had that economic franchise, that relationship, that low-cost model.
Right.
And it did. So he was willing to put in, initially, mostly preference shares rather than common stock.
The book is The Deals of Warren Buffett, Volume 1, The First 100 Million. My guest is Glenn Arnold, the author, I guess former college professor, we can say now.
Yeah.
Let's fast forward to 1964. He began investing in and accumulating shares, I think over a three-year period, of American Express.
Yeah.
Which is kind of interesting because we all know that company. And, you know, again, he's not that old. He's in his 30s, and he invests to the tune of $13 million, buying 5% of the company. First of all, I think that says a lot about his willingness to concentrate his money on fewer bets, where most managers like to spread their risk around and so on. But also, why did he pick American Express at that time? What was going on?
Well, the share price had fallen a lot, and the reason it had fallen was because of the salad oil crisis. American Express had guaranteed that a whole load of salad oil that was stored, I think in New York, was there and was valuable. And so a number of banks lent against that salad oil. And it was to a crook, a total crook. And what he did was fill the tanks with seawater and then put a bit of salad oil on the top, or where you actually go in and measure.
Because it rises to the top, right?
Yeah. So this crook got tens of millions out of various banks, and everything was fine. He could afford to repay. It was like a Ponzi scheme to some degree. And then all of a sudden, America imposed sanctions on Russia and refused the export of oil or something.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, the price of salad oil fell, and people went to reclaim their loans from this guy. And they all discovered that there was hardly any salad oil there at all.
Mm-hmm.
So American Express, having guaranteed this salad oil, had to pay up. or was threatened with various lawsuits.
Yeah.
And there was a period of time where it was wondering whether to pay up or not pay up. So the share price fell and Warren got in at that point. And the reason he got in was this economic franchise idea again. Up until about that time, Warren was highly influenced by Benjamin Graham's approach, where you look principally at the balance sheet. He was looking for net current asset value type investments, particularly. But here in American Express, we have an example of a company with not a particularly strong balance sheet, certainly not a net current asset value investment, but it had a strong franchise. So he had to check that out. And the way he checked that out was he knew that the American Express card was a world beater. It had, I can't remember the percentage, but something like 50% of the market at that time. Now, the question was, were people abandoning that card and therefore was the franchise reducing? So he went to restaurants and noticed that people were still using the American Express card. They were still going and getting traveler's checks, American Express traveler's checks. So people, ordinary people outside of Wall Street, were fine with American Express. They weren't worried about it. So he started accumulating these shares in American Express, thinking the franchise was absolutely fine.
Yeah.
In the minds of ordinary people, it was fine.
This idea of buying into a brand or franchise, I think, came from his partner, Charlie Munger. And I think Buffett started transitioning from the old Ben Graham ideas of buying a dollar's worth of assets on your balance sheet for 50 cents, which is what you were talking about, to thinking, well, you know, maybe there's a limit to that idea. Why don't we just talk about the ability of companies that have a strong brand name to be able to price their product with good profit margins, to increase prices over time and products, and grow with the earnings of that company? And I think that was, you think that was the beginning of that idea for him?
Around that sort of time, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Another one, pretty well the same year, was, I think the following year, was Disney.
Mm-hmm.
Again, Disney was bombed out. You could buy the whole of Disney for less than $100 million at that time.
Wow.
Yeah.
This was when Roy Disney was in charge before Michael Eisner got in charge? Is that the period of time?
You had Walt.
Oh, you had Walt. Still Walt. Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Warren was taken around Disneyland by Walt.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they got on like a house on fire. So that's another element there. You know, he really wants to know the people that are running these things.
Yeah, yeah.
And found Walt to be a great guy
and
obviously knew what he was doing in terms of business. So, you know, that's another element why he invested, apart from the franchise. I mean, the fantastic thing about that franchise is that you already had Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs made.
Yeah.
And all those other characters. And so the marginal cost of putting that out for the next generation of kids is hardly anything at all.
Yeah.
So it's a franchise that's got virtually no cost now.
Yeah.
And loads of income.
Well, I remember reading about that. I mean, after Walt died, Roy Disney took over and he was really unable to kind of unlock the hidden asset value of all these properties. And then they finally brought in Michael Eisner from Paramount.
Mm.
And I don't remember the dollar amounts, but, you know, Michael Eisner's ability to take sales from a relatively small number to some astronomic number is really what brought Disney into its current giant size and power. So this, again, this unlocking of value and seeing underlying value when it's not apparent, and it's not looking at the price to tell you whether this is a good company or not. That's so important. Everybody looks at a price. If a price like Google is $700, $800, $900 a share, they say it must be good. Now, I'm not saying Google's not, but if Google got down to $100 a share, people would start to say, well, maybe it's bad. Well, Glenn, we're out of time. I could do this for another 2 hours, I think, but unfortunately...
I'm me.
So congratulations on this book. For anybody who's interested in investing and kind of what it takes and what the mindset is, and you want to break away from the mindset of, you know, what the media expounds as the way to invest and so on and go your own way, this book is a good start for that. The book is The Deals of Warren Buffett, Volume 1, The First 100 Million. The author is Glenn Arnold. And if you want to hear this interview again, read its transcript, read a summary, Don't forget to come to our website, stevepomerantz.com. And while you're there, check out our weekly update, sign up for that, where you'll see every single segment that we do. You can read it, you can listen to it, or you can listen to the whole show. Glenn Arnold, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. All bull markets come to an end eventually. We all know that someday this party's going to stop. The question you need to ask yourself is, will I be ready when it does? Now, this is exactly the topic I'll be speaking on at my next event, which will be Tuesday, December 12th at 10 a.m. at the Aquilina Resort in Aventura. Now, while the timing of the next downturn can't be predicted, I will give you some insights as to what to look for to protect your wealth. Also, I'll talk about the questions that I'm constantly getting from listeners and clients. Questions like, what does the current administration's success or failure mean to the health of my wealth? And really, do politics even matter? What will be the effect, if any, of the new tax law if it's passed? And we know that high market volatility is going to come roaring back. So what can you do now to prepare and protect yourself? And can you even put yourself in a financial position where a downturn won't matter to you? I'll show you what it takes to do that. And of course, I'm going to help you break free from the terrible buy high, sell low, repeat until broke syndrome. All this and more. You know, always, my mission is to educate and empower you, which I've been doing for over 15 years on NPR affiliates and in my own investment practice for 35 years. So protect your wealth this holiday season and join me at the Aquilina Resort in Aventura, Tuesday, December 12th at 10 a.m. That's 10 a.m., Tuesday, December 12th at the Aquilina Resort in Aventura. Seating is limited, of course, so sign up at our website, stevepomerantz.com. That's stevepomerantz.com. You know, I just want to remind you that any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.